Hello and welcome to another episode of the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at RadioReverb.com, on DAB, and of course on our podcast. I'm Aidy Packham and we are the famous Brighton Hove Albion, and we're going to Wembley in association with oldfootballshirts.com. Yes, that's right, it's been quite the outstanding week here on Planet Albion. First, since we last spoke, Crystal Palace visited the Amex last Wednesday, and at last, they finally went home with nothing, with Solly March's 7th goal of the season, enough to earn all 3 points. And then, on Sunday, Grimsby came and were duly battered as we booked our place at Wembley in the FA Cup semi-finals, where we will face Manchester United. And in a nice little bit of symmetry, the Albion women's team also progressed to the FA Cup semi-finals, where they will also face Manchester United. Also this week, hot on the heels that of Adam Lallana last week, the club announced that Solly March has put pen to paper on a new deal that will keep him at the club until at least June 2026. Joining me today is, as ever, Alan Wes, and we are delighted to welcome back a man who is to spreadsheets what Marmite is to toast. And trust me, this man really loves Marmite. It's only Kieran Maguire.
Hello, Kieran. It's been a while since we've had you on. It feels like forever, doesn't it?
a full English week, absolutely.
English week. It is. I mean, it's been a stunning week. I mean, what do you want to start with? I mean, do you want to start with Palace or Marmite?
Let's do it chronologically. So,
well, Marmite splits opinion. Crystal Palace doesn't.
Yes. Okay. Well, let's put it this way, Aidy. Do you like Marmite?
I do like Marmite, yeah.
Right,
yeah.
So there's no split opinion on this forum.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, well, I mean, obviously, we've got to ask you this in your capacity as the co-host of the Price of Football podcast, which, as we will know, you do with Crystal Palace fan Kevin Day. So what is life like in Price of Football Towers this week?
It's one of the great things about the show is, originally, my hostility towards Crystal Palace was pretty unequivocal, and it has mellowed over the years. Yeah, I now go to the Pawson's Arms pre-match, and I'm with all the Palace fans, and it sort of reminds you of things such as Rempe, that we have more in common with Crystal Palace than we do with Chelsea or Liverpool or Manchester United, and that the club chooses us rather than we choose the club. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's part of your birthright, and the same goes for Palace. We have a really good relationship, and he won't want me to tell you this, but he even wished us well against Grimsby on Sunday.
I just liken the relationship to two brothers who fell out. The histories were very, very much parallel until the early 70s, and then they realigned again in the 70s and 80s. All right, they split apart again when we nearly went out of business, and I guess that they probably have had the bragging rights for the last quarter of a century or so. But, you know, here we are, we've just gone herring past them. And it's about time, frankly. I mean, you know, the natural order of the universe in that sense is restored.
Well, they've still not done the double over us since 1932.
And they've only ever done it once. That's the only time they've done it.
All right, okay.
When was the last time we did it? I can't remember.
A couple of years ago. Remember last time we beat them before this season?
Yeah, 4 years ago.
The Andoni one and knockout one.
But I mean, this game though, I mean, there was a lot of murmuring going on before the games. And obviously Patrick Vieira was under pressure. The news broke that they didn't have a goalkeeper and they had to put a kid in there who actually I thought was the guy that from the Rempe game, actually. He was about the same size anyway.
It looked like a mini version of Stuart Broad.
Yeah. So, to be fair, I mean, I've got to be fair to Palace here. I mean, you know, this was the best they played against us for quite some time. And, I mean, I think their game plan was actually just to try and keep the ball away from their keeper as much as possible. But they actually created a lot more chances than us, particularly in the first half, and actually should have been ahead before we scored.
Well, they probably know full well that they can only, you know, sort of ride their luck so often. If they'd have played what they'd have considered their previous game, or the setup that they had at Selhurst Park, then eventually one or two more of those chances which we'd have had would have gone in. So I think they just came out to us a little bit more, and it had the wherewithal of being a bit more effective. It took us 5 or 10 minutes to find our feet a bit, and then after that, we were cooking with gas. But once again, Pocher got in front of goal. But yeah, to say they were better, it means they weren't the sort of like the rollover, tickle your tummy puppies that they previously have been. But I don't know about this, Kieran. Do you feel that they've got some kind of curse over us in as much as, even though we're clearly at the moment the better side on a different trajectory from them, that we cannot play our normal game against them?
I think we did play our normal game at Selhurst Park.
Mm.
We threw away 2 points due to an unusual error from Robert Sanchez. Otherwise, we would have walked that game. Remember, we also had a perfectly good goal disallowed due to an error in VAR. So the gods were against us at Selhurst. I thought Palace started the game very well for the first 10 minutes. They were the better side. And it knocked us out of our rhythm. But once we'd worked out our rhythm, certainly after scoring the goal, Jason Steele didn't actually have anything to do, despite us trying to gift them an equaliser yet again.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, you had a couple of bits and balls. I mean, he had to be alert to come out to chase down Edward, a couple of times, and there was a shot he saved with his legs as well, which was a decent stop. But yeah, but I mean, it's weird. I mean, it's in a week where officiating is under the microscope again. I mean, there was a glaring error in this one from my point of view, from everyone around me's point of view, in the fact that they should have had a player sent off. I mean, Decore, I mean, how many yellow cards do you want?
It's one of those decisions where the referee doesn't want to send the player off. And I understand that from a referee's point of view. It looked like ungentlemanly conduct in terms of the nature of the foul, given that our player was breaking through. But referees have got a split decision in which to make, a split second in which to make a decision. And perhaps he erred on the size of caution there. Yeah, but I agree with you. Under normal circumstances, it was a yellow card, and therefore it was a second yellow card,
And then a third yellow card.
Yeah, I mean, if he hadn't already been booked, he would have got a yellow card for that.
Yeah, but that's why he got hooked at half time, right? So yeah. You know, I mean, it's unfortunately it's not a charity game, Kieran, is it? It's not. If it was one of our players, it was that we'd very much expect them to see red as well. I mean, it's happened. God knows it's happened to Lewis enough times, but it's not a charity. But I mean,
the thing about that is as much as we can complain about it, we appreciate it's not great officiating, in as much as. A foul, as we say, is always subjective, and it's always, quote, in the opinion of the referee. And just because the majority of people might think, don't get me wrong, in this instance, it's far more clear cut. But just because in the majority of people think it might have been a foul, in those sorts of things, it's not a democracy. It is down to one person. Clearly, he had an agenda of, as Kieran said, not wanting to send a player off. And to be honest, you know, lately, it's not as though Brighton Palace games have been blood and thunder, you know, thigh-high lunges, you know, cracking skulls sort of affairs. They've been a little bit cagey, almost to the point that, you know, the players realise they have to be over themselves a little bit in case one stand or other kicks off. So, you know, yeah, it's that kind of game. But that point aside, irrespective of the fact that most people thought it was, I think the telling thing is, and this is where you get a level of honesty that otherwise you wouldn't have had, the number of Palace fans reading on social media saying how he didn't get a second yellow, I've no idea. So, yeah, he got the hook because he was a walking red card.
Absolutely. OK, well, I mean, were we all aware of what the Ides of March were before the game?
Yeah, I know, but it's a bit something or nothing, isn't it? I mean, someone asked Roberto Di Zerbi about it. Is it fate? And I think I'd have ended up braining that questioner as well.
Well, you know, it's nice for March to score on the 15th of March in the 15th minute. It's great.
Yeah, it's really.
It was all to do with that great run from Matoma again. And perfectly weighted ball into Solly, Kieran, and finished with
aplomb, I believe, is the Heidi Packham
Yes, it is.
Registered word. I felt it was quite similar to the goal that Solly scored against Liverpool, in that he broke through, he split two defenders, took it on and put it right in the far corner. And that's one of the great things about what we've seen from Solly this season, is that A, he's willing to shoot, which perhaps he was a bit reluctant to. I think perhaps it was a confidence issue historically. And B, his shooting is, you know, people associated with the club just as I do. And the constant thing that comes back is that in training, Solly March is pretty much impossible to get hold of, because he is so good at what comes naturally to him. And we're now starting to see that on the pitch. It's just a shame that Gareth Southgate doesn't seem to see the same things that the rest of the population.
Yeah, has. I mean, on that one, I mean, I can sort of buy that it is, there are a lot of people ahead of him in the pecking order in that position. But the fact that Gareth Southgate was asked a question about Lewis Dunk and Solly and completely ignored the Lewis Dunk question. Mm. That's what annoys me. And when you're seeing like players picked who aren't even playing for their teams, when you've got one of the informed defenders in the country who's ready and hungry for another cap, it's just disappointing. I mean, it's not the first time this happened. It's not necessarily specifically just a Brighton problem. Other clubs have had these issues before, but it does seem to be very myopic.
But the point is that there is a reason, or there's probably several reasons, but let's narrow it down to one, i.e. the players are very, very good. There's a reason why we are in the position that we are. Yes, we've got a brilliant manager who's getting us playing brilliantly, but you have to be a decent player in the first place. Mm. Now, the only thing I can think of listening to Gareth Southgate, and it is painful, it is a fingernails down the blackboard sort of experience listening to him, is when he was talking about Brighton. He said they play this unique way, they play this amazing way, and everything screams to me. There was this hidden subtext underneath it that said they play this way that I either don't like, appreciate or understand, and is of absolutely no use to my England setup whatsoever.
Maybe. Maybe. Okay. Well, look, before we move on from this, we just got to highlight the other battle of the night, which was lots of fun to watch. And that was Joel Veltman v Will Saha, Kieran.
Part 7.
What, wonderful. It was. And I think actually both players quite enjoyed it.
Yeah.
Because, you know, Wilfred Zaha, he can sulk, as we're aware, but he gave it and he took it from Joel Veltman, who is the nearest thing that we've got to a Craig Bellamy stroke Robbie Savage shoutery type of player.
You reckon?
And I think he's magnificent in that role. He knows exactly what he's doing. He is Mr. 7 out of 10 every match. And the way that he dealt with Zaha, who let's face it, is an excellent player. You know, as much as he is our pantomime villain, but we all recognise that he's a pantomime villain for a reason.
Yes.
I thought it was an excellent performance from Joel.
Absolutely. Okay, yeah, well, let's move on to Sunday. We are FA Cup semi-finalists once again. It just felt like an occasion on Sunday.
I was just going to just say this. I mean, what a great day. Never mind the fact that we won 5-0. Never mind the fact we're in the semi-final. Just for every single aspect of things that are positive in football, what a great day.
It was wonderful. I mean, my sister had come across from Ireland and her husband, originally because I got them tickets to see the Albion play against Manchester United. And I got tickets instead I was fairly close to you, Alan, the West End Upper. Migrated from the cheap seats to the gods.
The lofty perch.
And yeah, it was the Grimsby fans I was chatting to on the train on the way to the match. They were friendly. They came in hope rather than expectation. There was one of their fans was eulogising about the way that Brighton Hove Albion looked after his son, who's got disabilities, and we put him into a sensory room, and there was a handwritten note.
That was fabulous. Yeah,
and for me, that is one of the many, many reasons why I've got a huge affection for Brighton Hove Albion, because they not only do they do the big things right, they do the little things right the vast majority of the time as well. And I think it was a wonderful and genuine gesture to look after one, you know. And the lad's dad's been in contact with me since and said, you know, I want you to win the FA Cup. I think most people in Grimsby want you to win the FA Cup. Everybody had a great day out.
Well, it was very nice for the Albion to actually think about you as well, and Phil, in the fact that they actually wore blue shorts.
Yes, that's great. I like. Yeah, it's just such a shame that you can't buy the blue shirts.
No, the Japanese have got more.
The blue shorts thing, in case you didn't realise, well, I mean, we've spoken about it a lot of time on the show, is the fact that because of Grimms, we're playing in an all pale kit. If we'd have worn the white shorts, then for colourblind people, again, the 1 in 12, it could have been caused an issue. So again, congratulations to the club for that. Now, Al.
Sorry, the thing I found about Grimsby's shirt is I did appreciate the fact, one, it looked like raw salmon. Two,
I thought it more prawny, actually.
Prawny, or two, it looked inside out. For those who don't know, my partner is from near Grimsby, a little village called Waltham. It's about 4 miles from Grimsby. She was born in Cleethorpes, so anyone who might have seen a reference to it, she's a Meggie. A Meggie is someone from Cleethorpes. One of her old school friends who missed out on, he wasn't one of the 4,621. He missed out on that. He was in Gran Canaria or something. He's on to me, or he's on to my partner, saying, can he get me a ticket? And I'm really reluctant because I've never met the fella before. But as it transpired, then the club offered the Goldstone restaurant, which is the 1901 restaurant in the East Stand. They offered that up to away fans. So it was another 100 fans they got in from Grimsby. For that, albeit it cost them 175 quid. And I did point out to him, you're not going to get 175 quid's worth of scran, but you can have as much drink as you want, so knock yourself out. As it transpired, he sort of just had a couple of drinks because he wanted to enjoy and watch the game. And he sort of took part in the whole thing that we take for granted, the whole culture of, you know, pints beforehand and natter before the game, watch the game. Cheer, moan, shout, scream, whatever. And then you must have, it's like a ritual, you have your post-match pint and your post-match post-mortem. These things are important. You know, if nothing else, it helps with the train situation. But of course, loads of Grimsby fans did that. Those that weren't getting on the buses, they all did that. So met in the West Stand lower. He rather likes Harvey's, which was very nice of him. And then we went to the evening start. And again, loads of Grimsby fans in there. I think you eventually turned up there, AD. And I think that was kind of the story for so many people, was that they took part in the sort of things that the Albion fans would have done automatically. And again, no one bats an eyelid. The whole thing that you get about away fans and home fans mingling, it's going to be a problem. Well, just have a look at that and show you it's not.
Mm. Okay. Well, I mean, we went into it full of hope and not expectation. But Denis, please score a goal for me. He should have had more than one, but he did take his goal with customary ease after finishing off after Caicedo's shot was saved.
You've gone, Kieran.
I thought we started on the front foot. Evan Ferguson had a good chance in the first minute. Mm. And I think we were confident that we were going to make an impact early on. He was the first to react. And I think that was one of the things which pleased me throughout the whole match, is that every ball that was in space, we really fought to try to ensure that we won it. You know, despite the fact that times we'd already, you know, the match was won. And for me, that's the sign of a good side, a hungry side. Manchester City do the same. You know, that when they were five up against Burnley, they wanted six, and when we were four up against Grimsby, we wanted five. I think Undav took his chance well, like many other players, like Billy Gilmore and so on. you're willing them to do well.
Yeah.
Even if perhaps at times they snatch a bit.
Yeah, there was the chance in the second half where he ballooned over. But I do, I mean, I think he got the assist for one
ballooned
of the...
Ballooned it!
I mean, the ball was last seen, like, trying to track down Leo Ojoa's penalty, I believe. But
the thing I was going to say about Undo following up for that first goal is that for those who have spent many, many years watching the Albion, the number of times where we've taken a shot, the keeper's spilt it, and there's no one following in has driven you around the absolute bend. So it's nice the fact that someone actually did bother their backside to go and chase the ball down. And if I was a Grimsby fan, you'd think, well, OK, clearly Brighton are the better side and we've got to sort of do our stuff. And I liken this to the first time we played in the Premier League. We played against Man City. Again, we knew we were going to get a hiding, but we matched up. Didn't really offer a huge amount, but the two goals we gave away were ones that you felt were avoidable. Now, every football fan will think that the goals that their team gives away is avoidable, but with that one, I won't say it was soft, but when you saw that Undav reacted so much quicker, or rather the Grimsby defenders didn't react at all to the save, you kind of find that disappointing.
Yeah, I mean, you reacted so quickly. Your first instinct, he must be offside, but there's no one there with him. But it clearly wasn't.
No, it was all good. So
now, Kieran, I mean, I'm going to ask you this question as somebody with leanings in this general direction. Evan Ferguson is a bright, exciting talent. And the people who are not in the know, can you just explain to him what side he is qualified to play for? Because it's not England.
It is the Republic of Ireland. I think he's the replacement for Frank Stapleton. I think he's that type of player. And I think you, in terms of his ability to hold the ball up, his close control for the second goal was absolutely exquisite. And you know, my family have come across from Ireland as much to watch Evan Ferguson as to watch the rest of Brighton Hove Albion. So it's a bit like when I bring down some of my students from the University of Liverpool, that it tends to be the Japanese students who are first to ask for tickets, and there's one reason why they want to come, and there's one player they want to watch. So to see him score a hat trick, even though one of them was disallowed, and rightly so, was great for all. But he's looking comfortable, and he looks like one of those players. A bit like Haaland. Now, I'm not comparing him directly to Haaland. Haaland's five goals against Burnley were scored from a collective 12 yards. I think what Evan Ferguson is good is being in the right place at the right time. And if he's doing that at the age of 18, in 10 years' time, when he's at his footballing peak, I suspect he will be a very successful player if he continues this level of progress. And I think we've got to be careful to say that, you know, some players plateau, some players go backwards. Everything I hear from him from Ireland, which is also everything I hear about another player from Ireland whose career has perhaps fallen off a bit, backs up what I've heard in terms of their personalities. Mm. That Ferguson is a very grounded, a very proportionate young man, and very professional in his outlook.
Yeah, I mean, what Kieran was saying there. I mean, most of his work, it's done within the width of the penalty box, isn't it?
It is, but it's also about making sure that the link-up plays is correct. And he's also got an eye for being in the right place at the right time, and not necessarily being a six-yard sniffer. I'm talking about being, you know, that when he's part of the build-up, that's 30, 40 yards from goal. You know, he's going to bring in, you know, the ball will come to him, he'll bring in Matoma. The ball's going to come to him, he'll knock it back to Caicedo. I mean, there's the times when we've seen him use his body, Glenn Murray-like, to hold off an absolute, you know, sort of beast of a player behind him. So he's got that sort of strength as well. And he's, and I hate this cliche, but I'm going to say it, for a big lad, he's exceptionally mobile. I mean, he's not necessarily overly fast, but he's not sort of one setting hack kick either. He has a deft touch about him, and I did like the comment from Danny Murphy made with Glenn Murray, saying that they were debating as to whether he was a natural left footer or a right footer. They couldn't tell.
Well, that's you know, every footballer should be both footed.
Well, yes, I know.
Which is why I'm not a footballer.
Maybe. Exactly. Well, you know, you are two-footed, AD. It's just both at the same time.
Yeah, no, well, no, I can't be two-footed. I usually both my feet are usually in my mouth. So it's
well, quite no. There's okay. Let me put this to you Kieran. Can he beat Robbie Keane's record?
Not necessarily, because I'm not sure. One man can't do it by himself, and I'm not sure that Evan Ferguson will have 10 men around him at the caliber that Robbie Keane had at times. So it is a team game, and for the Republic, it is going to be, unless some more players come through, it's going to be a trial going forwards.
There appears to be a lot of them here, Kieran. So with the likes of Moran and O'Mahony, they could all be in the same side together. So
it's been quite a fertile sort of fishing area for us for quite a while, isn't it?
South America. Okay, but I mean, before we move on, I want to talk about my favourite goal of the game, which was a diving header, Keith Houchin style from Solly March.
How many passes?
Was it 600?
It was
a lot.
And I think that was... If that had been the only goal of the game, I think that it had got a huge amount of attention. You know, the patience, the precision, the final delivery, and Solly's finish. Because the game was effectively over, I think that goal didn't get the credit that it deserved. But it was a magnificent effort in terms of the philosophy of football that we're now playing under Roberto. And it's that which that gives you hope. You know, we have a playing budget that's a quarter of that of Manchester United, and yet we go into the FA Cup semi-finals very much as equals, in my view.
Yeah, we've got a very, very good chance of progressing through to the final here. I mean, for symmetry's sake, I would have liked to have United in the final, but 40 years on. But just name drop Clang. I have been chatting to Gordon Smith this week, and he is ready. He's on his way to Wembley.
Is he going to score this time?
He has scored there before.
But
the only thing I was going to say about that particular goal, and you're talking about the number of passes again, listening back to the commentary later, was that Jonathan Pearce, himself, someone who's, you know, sort of very familiar in this parish, you know, he almost accused Brighton of showboating. That was the phrase he used. Brighton are going to be careful not to be showboating here with the number of passes. And there wasn't showboating as such. We're not talking about keepy uppies and sort of like jiggling on your shoulder or anything like that. But you know, he was kind of, I think he was getting stressed, and he was getting frustrated about, come on, Brighton, look, you've got the ball, get the thing in there. And then with that, crosses the ball in and in it goes. But yeah, the whole thing of being patient enough. So, and again, coming back to this fellow Dave that stayed with us from Grimsby, he was saying about, you know, what we were hoping for is we get to 70 minutes. And this is in discussion about how we thought that game might go. You know, we'll get to 70 minutes. We keep it a 0-0 or even just 1-0. And, you know, the crowd starts getting frustrated and starts getting on their back. And this is the thing about watching the Albion, certainly at home over the past dozen games, certainly since De Zerbi took over, but even before that, when Potter's was on an upward curve, was that we've had some seriously entertaining games. Not every result's gone the right way, but we've had some seriously entertaining games. And so even if it had gone to 70 minutes, I probably wouldn't have been worried. In fact, I'd have felt quite the opposite, on account of the fact you think, well, we're going to keep the ball, you're not going to have it. By 70 minutes, your lot are going to be knackered. And that's when we start running the goals. And it's exactly what happened. But, you know, I think they were just frustrated that, like I said, we scored in the sixth minute of the first half, the sixth minute of the second half. And that just gave us a platform for the kids to come on and run riot, really.
Yeah. Before we move on from that, I do just want to mention Iari, who made his Albion debut on Sunday, who I thought looked very, very impressive.
Well, I do love the way his first attempted first touch was to throw himself over his own shoulder.
But he had, I thought that too, but then I realized he touched the ball about 30 seconds before.
Which
is a shame. But I mean, he's an exciting prospect, Kieran.
He's one of many. If 2 years ago, a player of the caliber of Yves Bissouma or Mark Cookeray or Leandro Trossard had left the Albion, I think we would have all been wailing and gnashing of teeth. But now we see it as part of the evolution of the player's career and also the club. And there is a degree of confidence that because the club has this incredible concept of succession planning and a strategy and a process, that every player that leaves is creating an opportunity for somebody else. You know, for Trossard, it was Mitoma. If Caicedo or McAllister goes, you know, Jeremy Sarmiento is looking really promising. Billy Gilmore could come into the equation, and so on. And the players will be given a platform in which they can flourish, as opposed to, and this isn't a criticism of Chris, because Chris did create the foundations for us, A, to get to the Premier League, and B, to survive in the Premier League. We didn't have that, three or four years ago.
Okay. Well, we are at Wembley. We'll obviously more of that to come over the coming weeks as we look forward to that. But you are listening to the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at radioreverb.com, and DAB, and of course on our podcast. This show, as ever, is brought to you in association with the brilliant oldfootballshirts.com. And Phil has provided us with another interesting shirt to have a look at. It's blue, Kieran.
Yes, yeah, it is blue, and I was trying to work it out, and I think I picked up from the badge. It's got an EFL little badge, and then looking at the crest, is it Luton?
Yes, it is.
Oh, right.
That was easy.
I was looking, because I'm sort of old school, and I expect Luton's away shirts to be orange, but...
That's their home shirt now.
A home shirt, is it? I don't know
when they went from white to orange or why they went from white to orange. I mean, I see them. I think I'm about to get on an EasyJet flight every time I go.
I always associate Luton with wearing orange, especially in the 70s. The orange shirt with the black and white vertical stripe down one side. It sounded, to be honest, blue seems a bit of an anathema if you're saying that's their first kit, their home kit.
The blue isn't their home kit, no.
I thought you said it was. So the other thing is that it's an interesting point you raise about history, and this is where probably if Phil was on here, he'd start sort of boring for England, is that I love the fact that this badge that they've got there, which is kind of a four-cornered crest, I assume is either the Borough of Luton or maybe some reference to Bedfordshire or maybe a hybrid, is that this is traditionally what a football badge used to look like. Think of the old Albion badges of the forces, you know, with the plain blue shirt and white sleeves. It's got the twin crest on one badge. This whole thing of graphic design of the 70s, from the 70s onwards, came in with our, obviously, Seagull in a roundel. But for a long, long time, if you see an old QPR shirt, for instance, from the 60s, its badge is the crest of the London Borough of Hammersmith. Silly things like that. I know. I'm going to say something interesting in a minute. So can you tell us about this shirt, AD?
Yes, I can. And here is your shirt of the week, says Phil. And this is the 1992-94 third shirt of Championship side Luton Town. The side was formed in 1885 and they play at the 10,356 capacity Kenilworth Road Stadium. A new 17,500 capacity stadium is being planned, but several setbacks, including planning, finance and COVID, have caused some delays. In the 1992-93 season, Luton played in the glamorously named Anglo-Italian Cup, which was conceived as a tournament for the teams in the English and Italian second flight. Luton were in the newly named Division One at the time. 92-93 was the inaugural Premier League season, and the glamour ties awaited for them. And with a 0-0 draw away at AS Watfordy, and then elimination from the preliminary rounds with a 1-1 draw at the hands of Pistoia Citeria. That's how the Anglo-Italian thing cut. They played Watford and Bristol City. There are plenty of links to Brighton. Most notably, recently, Nathan Jones, with two spells as the Hatters manager. I bet he wishes he was still there. When this shirt was in use between 92 and 94, there were a couple of Albion links. Aussie goalkeeper Andy Pettersson was between the sticks for Luton. He made 7 league appearances for the Seagulls in 2002. Yeah, he was the keeper, Phil, that got caught outside his box and then fell over. Yes, less than about that.
Yeah.
Defender Jamie Campbell began his career at Luton in 91, playing there for 4 seasons before journeying around for a bit. He spent the 1999-2000 season with Dean. And in the 93-94 season, Paul Dickoff was on loan from Arsenal. Later in the season, he was playing 8 games for Brighton, scoring 5 times. Actually, Paul Dickoff was a good player for us. It's like...
He played now and again. Obviously, you've got things like Fozzy, you had Kurt Nogan was at both clubs. There's probably loads of others, none of which...
Nobby and Tony Grealish were swapped.
Yes, absolutely, yes. Danny Wilson.
Yeah. So, yeah. So, Phil, you missed out a load there. on the North Stadium. Is that 10... Did you really say that they're only looking to build a 17,000-seater stadium?
Yeah, that's apparently so, yeah.
Talk about poverty of ambition.
If they can't fill it, what's the...
let's put it this way. We never... No point ever did we fill with Dean, and yet, by the same token, at no point did we ever not think that we weren't going to fill the Amex, or Falmer, as it was going to be.
But remember, when we moved to the Amex, it was a 21,000-capacity stadium. And this, I think, was, again, another stroke of genius by Tony Bloom. We all bought into that. Tony Bloom was one step ahead of the rest of the planet. By creating the stadium in such a way that the capacity could have been increased, and then it has subsequently increased.
Exactly. So, like I said, and maybe Luton have got that in mind, because like I said, you try and sell the notion of a 32,000-seater stadium for a team that's mid-table in the third division at the time that can't even fill its current stadium. So, 21,000, 22,000, whatever the Falmer started off as being.
Was
probably a not unreasonable number, but even then, back then, you had the naysayers said, "Oh, we'll get 12,000 or 14,000."
Now, Kieran, now there's many things that make you happy. listening to Joy Division. You had a wonderful time at Killing Joke the other day. You've got your own Marmite spreader. I know that makes you happy, but the sight of a spreadsheet or someone's accounts, even, they have you like a you're absolutely in clover. And the Albion accounts are out. How happy are you, Kieran?
I'm happy on 2 levels. A, that the accounts are out, and B, it's record profits for the club in its history, and in fact the club made more profits in 21-22 than even the total revenue that they generated in any season up to 2017. So it's been magnificent, both on the pitch and off the pitch, last year. And some of the numbers are quite gobsmacking. Last season, we finished 9th in the Premier League with the 19th biggest wage bill. So we were second bottom when it came to wages. And yet, if ever there is a case of looking at the genius of Tony Bloom and Paul Barber and the rest of the team, and it is very much a team effort, I think it's reflected in these numbers, because football is a talent game and the talent follows the money. The Albion's wage bill was £115 million. Manchester United, who finished, 3 places above us, their wage bill was £384 million. So for every £100 that they're paying in wages, I think we're paying something like 27, 28, it shows that buying well, I think it shows that having a strategy and a process and all of these things that some people have been a bit sniffy about historically, has now started to fall into place. And yes, it has taken time, but it's now bearing fruit. So there's lots of good things. It's record revenues for the club. It's certainly record profits. It's record player sales. Everything was just incredible. We've done extremely well.
When you say record profits, do you mean actually the club will be posting a profit.
Yes, the Albion made a pre-tax profit of £24 million. Now, it's got to be said that had they not sold Ben White, they would have posted a loss. So the losses from what you might call the day-to-day running of the club was around about £33 million. And if you are losing money on a day-to-day basis, you've either got to have the owner there to plug the gap, or you start to utilise the player trading model through selling talent. And that's what the Albion did. And they made profits of £62 million from selling players. So that bounced the loss into a profit. That's going to be repeated in 22-23 because we've got the sales of Bissouma, Kukurea, Mope, Trossard. And that's just four players. Remember, there's other players that go under the radar that we don't see. It's an incredible set of results.
And Graham Potter and his staff as well.
Yes, because if you look at the small print of the accounts, if you go to the very last page, and a set of accounts isn't like a novel. You know, in a novel, you will read it to the very last page because that's when the big reveal will often take place. Where in a set of accounts, most people have fallen asleep by then. They look at the big numbers, but the compensation that was paid by Chelsea for taking Graham Potter was £21.5 million. Now, I appreciate that's for Graham Potter and his support staff, but let's face it, be honest, but they didn't come in for Benny and Bjorn, and they came in for Graham. And would Chelsea have come in for Bruno and Ben Roberts had Graham not been going there? I suspect not. So, and again, I go back to the genius of Bloom and Barber because. Yeah. It was they who saw after, 2.5 months of Graham being at the helm, where the results were okay, but they weren't outstanding, that they saw in Graham something which they wanted to lock into. And that's when they got him to sign a 6-year contract. And had they not got him to sign that 6-year contract, we wouldn't have got £21.5 million in compensation. Yeah. So we got that £21.5 million in compensation. Plus, there was just shy of £90 million, a positive net spend in the sense that we generated £90 million more than we spent, and yet we're higher up in the table. We've made more progress in the cups. We're scoring more goals than we did last season, and it's incredible to see something which I would perhaps cover at business school as this is how to have a strategy. This is how to deliver a strategy. And we'd all look at it from a theoretical point of view. Well, this is taking that theory. It's applying it in a real world. It's applying it in an industry which is incredibly competitive, which is incredibly wage dominated. And it's generating results in terms of financial and performance in the key performance indicators that you associate with football, which is winning matches, scoring goals, and blocking shots and going to Wembley.
Yeah. Now, Kieran, I mean, anyone who regularly listens to your show will know all about the likes of amortisation and the fact that when clubs pay £60 million for a player, very rarely are they paying that money up front. Now, the transfer of Ben White, it was done in instalments. Is that right?
But that's right. So at the end of 21-22, so at the 30th of June, the Albion were actually owed £49 million from other clubs in respect of outstanding instalments. So a significant amount of that will be from Arsenal in respect of Ben White. A significant amount of that, of course, will be also our other major sale of last season, which was Dan Burn to Newcastle United. So as a result of that, and this is where people might seem a bit confused, Tony Bloom lent more money to the club. People say, well, why did he need to lend money to the club in a year in which they've made profits? Is that whilst they've made profits, that's great, but profits aren't the same as cash. So both Ben White and Dan Burn were effectively sold on credit, and Tony Bloom has effectively plugged that credit gap and paid off the loan, which was due to the lenders, the bank lenders that had been taken out the previous season. So we're now in this incredible position in that Tony Bloom, who surely can do, well, he can do no wrong in my view. He's put in, based on my figures here, £499 million, you know, £500 million of his own money in the form of both shares and interest-free loans. There are other clubs who have owners that lend money to them who charge interest, but Tony Bloom is Brighton through and through, and we know just how fortunate we are to have both him and Paul Barber at the helm of the club, because I think they are a fantastic double act, and they complement each other very well with their skill sets.
Absolutely. Costs up slightly, but wages and other expenses under good control. Can you clarify that one?
Yeah, the wage bill went up by 6% in a year in which inflation rose by 10. We also have to take into consideration in 2021, that was a season which took place behind closed doors, and therefore, the Albion didn't have to employ matchday staff. So, a significant amount of the increase in the wage bill will be paying the back office staff, the ground staff, the support staff on match days, and so on, which had to be paid in 2022, who weren't being used in 2021. As I mentioned earlier, based on my figures, and not all clubs have submitted their accounts yet, but you can normally get a fairly good feel for these things. I think we've potentially got the 19th out of 20 biggest wage bill in the Premier League. And normally there's a very, very strong correlation between wages and final league position. But we are very much an outlier with regards to that. 19th biggest wage bill, finishing ninth in the Premier League is an achievement, and everybody that contributed towards that, the players, the managers, the coaching staff, but also the recruitment team as well, have to take a huge amount of credit.
Now, if you listen to anyone on a non-Albion person on any given social media platform, or even within the media, they'll tell you what a brilliantly run club the Albion is. Now, I think they're going to be looking at it from a different viewpoint, in as much as we've lost Potter, we lost this, we lost that, and we've managed to replace them. So they see that from the outside on the surface of things. With what you're saying here of 19th highest wage bill, but yet then finishing ninth, this, I guess, is probably an even more pertinent indicator of, quote, how well the club is run.
Yes, because we have seen some other clubs in recent years under new owners accelerate the spend in terms of transfer spend, accelerate the wages being paid to players. And there's one player who went from another, let's face it, we are a small club. We're not a small club in the same sense of Crystal Palace, in terms of, but in the pecking order, we are a small club. I know one player that went from a club to another 14 club, and his wages went from £45,000 a week to £140,000 a week, because that club wanted to shortcut its progress up the Premier League. But they bought players. I think what Brighton have done is that they bought a team. My focus, my background is very much focusing on the non-football fixtures and then linking them to KPIs in terms of football. And here I think the Albion are punching above their weight, whatever metrics you use, whether it's wage control. We're only spending £66 in wages for every £100 that's coming through the door. Well, we've got other clubs which are as high as 95. And we've got clubs in the Championship spending £243 in wages for every £100 that comes through the door. The net spend last season was £1 million. And if you say that to a Newcastle fan, a Liverpool fan, a Manchester City, a Manchester United fan, oh yeah, we're aiming for a net spend of £1 million, that they go into apoplexy.
It's just incredible.
So whatever metric you look at, we are punching above our weight. Yeah. The total squad cost at the end of last season was £193 million. Now, Manchester City's is over £1 billion. So they've spent £800 million more on their squad than we have. Manchester United's squad has cost £990 million. So their squad has effectively cost £800 million more than ours. We've beaten Manchester United on the last two occasions that we've played them. The club has a plan, and the trouble is social media and mainstream media, and I'm not being critical here, they're not interested in plans because plans take a long time to come to fruition, whereas I think there is a patience at the Albion which isn't replicated anywhere. Yeah, when Graham Potter went through a phase in last season when we went through a phase,
we lost six games in a row,
and was it 3 wins in 25? It sort of in that middle season,
couldn't win at
part
home
of the season. There wasn't the clamour for a dismissal. I think the fans have got faith in the people at the top of the club, and therefore they've also got faith in the manager as a result. And that you could see that the performances were good, even if the results weren't. And sometimes you've got to be patient. And I think being patient is a huge virtue, because if you're not patient, you just have a rotating door policy when it comes to the head coach's position. And every head coach has a different perception of football. We've got a huge amount of stability.
Yeah. No, I mean, Kieran, last season was record-breaking on the pitch, a highest ever top-flight finish. This season, we're looking to exceed that. We're looking at the European places for the first time ever. And it's not, for once, it's not actually just a pipe dream. There is a reality that this could actually happen. Now, how would that affect the club going forwards? Not in terms of recruitment, but also with the players that are already here, would there be clauses in contracts in regards to, and would they then earn more money if we qualified for a European competition, for instance?
My understanding is that there is a highly incentivized bonus structure at the Albion. I'll be honest, if we qualify for the Europa Conference, that's a European adventure for the fans. As far as the club is concerned, it won't make any money. If we get into the final stages, then we might be making a bit of money, but we'll be talking single millions, no more than that. Because not only will the players have bonuses, and I think probably other members of staff, everybody is incentivized pay-wise at the club, which I think is, again, a very egalitarian approach. But we'll have to be honest, say that the squad's not big enough to cope with Sunday, Thursday, Sunday, Thursday. So therefore, we will have to bring in new players specifically to be squad players who will be representing the club in the European tour, should it go ahead. And you know, let's face it, we've still got to play Arsenal, Spurs, Manchester United, Manchester City and Chelsea. So you know, there's some really tough fixtures coming up in the final couple of months of the season. But what we're going to experience between now and the end of the season, I think, is what we can expect to see next season should we qualify for one of the European competitions, which is similar to what we went through in the Championship. You know, that we got into that mentality of Saturday, Tuesday, Saturday, Tuesday. Well, this is going to be Sunday, Thursday, Sunday, Thursday for both the Europa Conference and the Europa League, should we qualify for that. The chances of qualifying for the Champions League is probably no more than 1.5%. But if anybody had told me at any point during my Brighton Hove Albion supporting life that with 12 matches to the seasons to go, we had a 1.5% chance of qualifying for the Champions League, I would have taken that, and I would have also phoned to the nearest hospital for the person telling me the story.
But Kieran, I can point out, I guess, I just
say
Yeah, I just need to point out, I have looked at the league table. I think we're over 40 points now. We're safe.
Yes.
Yes, about absolutely. Time. About time. So, Kieran, obviously we were talking about players that were sold, but not every player left us through the usual legitimate means. What happened? Have the Albion put down in their accounts what they've done about Enoch Mwepu?
Well, I mean, yeah, this is such a tragedy for Enoch that his career has been ended at such a young stage. The club have written off his transfer, so we've reported a profit of £24 million, but they've written off over £8 million because, without wanting to get excited about amortization, and I know AD knows this is one of my favourite words.
Oh yes.
When you sign a player, you spread the cost of the contract over the period through which the player's registered. And you know, with the sad news about Enoch and that his career is now ended, that they took the hit in the 21-22 accounts. If they hadn't done that, the profits would have been over £30 million.
Kirill, I can't remember how much we signed Enoch for, but I mean, were we paying that by instalments? Or so would we have had to pay Red Bull more, Salzburg more money?
No, because the payment schedule is completely independent of what subsequently right. happens to the player. So that will be unaffected by what has happened to Enoch. But you know, I think it's the one sad thing that we've really had over the course of the last 18 months. Yes, players have gone on, but you know, I think with the exception of Mark Cucurella, whose agitation for a move, his dream move to Manchester City, and then his dream move to Chelsea in the same week, I think there's been no resentment towards the other players who have left. You know, Dan Burn was a popular member of the squad, and he's returned home. Ben White, we all knew that he was destined for other things, and because he played his one season for us took place during lockdown, I think the bond between player and fans was never there in the first place. So that was, you know, as we sang, £50 million in the bank. Tony Bloom is very happy. And that's worked very well. So the numbers are ridiculously good.
Okay, so we've got about 45 seconds left now, Kieran. With what you've seen and been through, and obviously you're going to have to do a lot of interviews in the coming days now, could you just finish off by giving us your brief overview as to what you think the state, the healthiness of the club's finances and the direction of the club is at the moment?
The Albion's finances have never been as good as they are in March 2023. The club is still indebted to Tony Bloom's benevolence and his genius. We did pay Star Lizard £3 million over the course of last season to use some of their skills. And it's in a very strong position going forwards because it doesn't have to sell any players. So if I was marking it as an educator, I'd give it an A+.
But that is all we've got time for this week. So, of course, thank you so much to Alan West. Thank you to Kieran Maguire. I've been Ailey Packham. This has been the Albion Roar on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM. Online at RadioReverb.com, on DAB, and, of course, on a podcast and in association with OldFootballShirts.com. Thanks for listening. We'll see you soon. Bye.
Come I feel twisting the bones until they snap. I scream.